Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 958. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at our Reformed Forum headquarters, and I'm really excited and happy to be back and speak more Presbyterian history. It's my thing of late, of the last couple of years. But to do that, we have a first-time guest, a friend, a new friend, and I'm very excited to welcome to the program Dr. David T. Irving, who now serves as president of Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome, David. It's so good to see you today.
Thanks, Camden. Really great to be here.
Yes, we just got back from Twin Lakes not too long ago. You've done a conference with a dear buddy of mine, Jim Cassidy, down in New Braunfels, along with mutual friend Nick Bullock. And I got to see you present at Twin Lakes the prior year as well. So your neck of the woods. It's great to catch up with you in virtual space. And we're going to be speaking today about David's dissertation, Mississippi's Greatest Minister, a historical study of Cornelius W. Grafton's 61-year pastorate, 1873 to 1934. I should mention also that you were able to present on some of this at the Greenville Confessional Conference recently. So I'm excited. I had the dissertation before that, so I knew a lot of what you were already going to be speaking about at Greenville, although it's even better to see you present and talk about the stories and the history personally. So I'm excited to open that up to people today. We're going to speak about all of that. But before we get into that, David, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your time at RTS Jackson, speaking now about your relatively fairly recent transition to becoming the president and some of the things you have going on at the campus lately.
Thanks, Camden. Well, I'm excited to get to talk about Dr. Grafton, and it's fun to get to speak with you. I was mentioning to you off air what a help this program has been to me, even going back to my days as a seminary student, so this is really a treat. And you're right, I less than a year ago made the transition from pastoring a local church in South Mississippi to serving as the president here at RTS. It's been a great honor to work with Ligon Duncan, who was both my pastor and a professor when I was a student, and also so many colleagues men who are now colleagues who were professors of mine. And it's an exciting time to be at RTS. We've got a great team, and I've enjoyed getting to know all the different parts of the seminary, teaching in the classroom, getting to spend time with our supporters, learning all of the administrative work that goes in to RTS. Just less than 3 years ago, our campus moved from our original campus close to Clinton, further to the west, to a new facility. We've been very blessed in that. Puts us so close to our churches, where so many of our students worship, to folks in the community who can come and take classes. So we're thankful for that. And one of the things, I would say the biggest surprise to me coming, you know, there were all sorts of things I was expecting to need to learn or to deal with. I would say the biggest surprise to me since starting the job has been learning about the shortage of pastors in the Reformed world.
Yeah.
I think when I was a student, there was something of a narrative, at least in the PCA, that we had loads of teaching elders and just a perhaps even a paucity of opportunities for them. Now that narrative is really flipped. And the number of times I'll have churches calling me either for candidates or for interns, and I'll look at our students and say, so many of our students are already committed or already actively and faithfully serving in internships or in roles that will turn into calls, God willing. And so that has been a part of the role that I did not expect. It's an exciting challenge for us to try to stir up in the churches both an awareness of and prayers for the pastoral shortage and for God to raise up more laborers. But that's really been a focus of the time so far as I've been learning the job, is thinking, how can we get as many men in to train for pastoral ministry? How can we help churches as they seek to cultivate candidates for the ministry? So I've been really enjoying the time, and that's been a big part of the first 10 months or so.
Well, it's great to hear, and it certainly is a great need. I was recently spending time with some of my Continental Reformed brothers, particularly in the United Reformed Churches in North America, and they have an even I mean, it's bad across NAPARC, but it's especially challenging even in the URCNA. And there are many, many churches without pastors. And if you just look at the pipeline, so to speak, there aren't as many people lined up and ready to go. So the fields are white for the harvest, as we say, as the Lord has said. But we need people to be raised up and people to be sent and to get trained. We don't want to send unqualified people into pulpits by any stretch. So this is already an issue, but even the further along it goes, the worse it's going to get as more people retire and move on to other things. So yes, that's a great need.
Impression. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my impression too. And talking, as you said, to brothers in a host of denominations, PCA, OPC, mm-hmm. EPC, URC, are expressing similar concerns. And if I could place a burden, on brothers and sisters in the local church, it would just begin by committing yourselves in your prayer meetings and your pastoral prayers. Lord, yeah. Raise up laborers for the harvest. I think some churches are aware, but it seems to me there's a greater awareness among seminaries, among missionary sending agencies, mm-hmm. than there is in local churches. But of mm-hmm. course, eventually local churches are going to feel that shortage. So may God raise up an army of prayers who pray up an army of ministers.
Yes.
For the years to come.
For all aspects of the Great Commission. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need it. Hopefully we don't, that every church would have all the officers that they need, that every minister would be able to shepherd a flock. As we're going to talk about Grafton today, he pastored two flocks. So we don't want to get to a situation where that's normative, I don't think. It's a little irregular. We can talk about why that was. But today we're speaking about this dissertation, as I mentioned, Mississippi's Greatest Minister, an historical study of Cornelius W. Grafton's 61-year pastorate. The dates 1873 to 1934 for people's interest. And so they can situate that. This was a dissertation submitted to the faculty at the University of Mississippi, 2023, so relatively recent, and excited to speak about that. Now, David, you don't come from Mississippi. You've got connections there, and obviously you've been around the block. You know it well. I love how your brothers often speak about the counties. I do that a lot. I've spent all my life in Illinois except 5 years I was in Philadelphia for my MDiv and PhD. We talk that way sometimes. I know. But it's like when I'm coming as an outsider, I don't necessarily even know where all the cities are situated with one another. But it's ever more common, I think, even for people that are well familiar with Mississippi to be speaking about different valleys, regions, counties, and just to know all that stuff, and not only to know where those things are, but to know a deep and rich history there. And that's something you're well-versed in. Even I just hear it. I don't know if you recognize how much it comes out of you naturally. And that's a good thing, being a seminary president down in Jackson, but also knowing this history. I'm wondering how you got connected, if you could share with people a bit about your connection to Mississippi and ultimately to this figure, Cornelius W. Grafton.
Sure, I'd be glad to. And I count that a compliment.
It is a compliment.
I feel familiar in Mississippi. So I grew up in New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire, about an hour north of Boston, and grew up in a wonderful family. We attended worship every Sunday. We were involved in church, but it was a liberal mainline congregation, United Church of Christ. So I really don't remember hearing the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, dying and rising again, and that salvation is by grace through faith. I really don't remember hearing that, but the habits of worship, and in some ways downstream from the New England Puritan tradition in terms of the forms, that was very much a part of my upbringing, for which I'm so thankful to God and my parents' faithfulness in that. When I got to high school, I started pushing back against some of that religious upbringing and was introduced in high school and then in college to some Bible-believing evangelicals and met people, especially in college, who had Bible answers to the spiritual and philosophical questions that gnawed at me. I wrote my admissions essay to college on why I thought no intelligent person could believe that only one religion was true. And then about 18 months later, through an athlete's Bible study, came to faith in Christ.
Wow.
as time went on in college, the Lord opened some doors, shut other doors, and I began to sense a call to the ministry. A friend of mine at Dartmouth had gone to RTS in Jackson and had an excellent experience there. My pastor, who had grown up at 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, was a Reformed pastor. He said RTS was a good place to go. So 5 or so days after college graduation, never having visited Mississippi before, I drove from New Hampshire to Mississippi to start RTS. It was a bit of a culture shock at first, but had wonderful roommates, professors, and church friends that welcomed me, lifelong Northerner, into their circle of Christian friendship and fellowship. And so I came to seminary pretty much expecting that I would head back northeast, and in God's providence, had opportunity to serve in an intern role at a small local church, 30 minutes outside of Jackson in Raymond. At the same time, got married to a gal from down here who had grown up PCA, multiple generations of shorter catechism memorizers, and Southern Presbyterian, wonderful, godly family. And I had the opportunity to stay on and serve as a pastor in Raymond after graduation. So that's what I did. And it was in that context that I started to dive more into Presbyterian history in Mississippi. My wife's grandfather had told me about Cornelius Grafton, who's actually a distant relative of my wife's family. And he had his picture in his home. He knew about him being elected moderator of the General Assembly in 1916. Knew some of the stories of his pastorate, had read the biography that was written about Grafton in 1942. So I'd heard about this figure through relatives, through in-laws. And then as I was serving in Raymond, I was trying to become better acquainted with Mississippi Presbyterianism, and come to find out Grafton had written more than 650-page history of Presbyterianism in Mississippi. So I started diving in more to try to understand the context in which I was serving. I was a history major in undergrad, so those interests married well. And as time went on and I was thinking about PhD study, he became in some ways an obvious choice for a few reasons. One, there was the personal interest, and you know, you got to pick a topic that'll hold your attention for a number of years. Two, the Department of Archives in Jackson has 7 boxes of his papers that had been largely unstudied. There was, as I mentioned, a biography written in 1942. But I had the combination of an interest and a treasure trove of primary sources that had been largely ignored. And then it was also practical for me as a pastor. You know, I'm going to be studying this figure in the context of a history department, engaging with various historiographic discussions. But I was also reading sermons, Reformed sermons. I was learning the rhythms, his rhythms of pastoral ministry. And so it checked a number of helpful boxes for me to, you know, I introduced through family members, helped with a historical interest, and then worked out really nicely to be able to do further research. So I'm thankful in God's providence that all of those things aligned.
Oh, that's amazing. It's really, there's so many astounding things here to discuss, and Grafton's an exceedingly interesting figure, but one who hasn't necessarily been treated with the attention that he perhaps deserves. I mean, you describe Grafton as someone whose contemporaries believed his death was worthy of 3 consecutive days of newspaper headlines, yet at the same time, he wasn't really factored prominently in the historiography of religion in the South. Why do you think he's kind of been overlooked, and does that oversight indicate anything about how we study Southern religious history, for example?
Sure, that's a good question. You're exactly right that the Jackson newspaper ran front page articles 3 days in a row. And actually the title for my dissertation, Mississippi's Greatest Minister, is a title of one of those articles.
So you're not being hyperbolic. You know, you're quoting an historical source.
So in one sense, it's unsurprising. As much as I love Dr. Grafton and appreciate his significance, he did not write a major published work. We could talk more about his history later on that was unpublished. he was a General Assembly moderator, so there was certainly denominational notoriety there, and very well known in the state, both on account of his longevity, on account of his work as an educator. So
his column too.
He was very well.
And a little bit of a column too. He did write.
Did. So there was a Mississippi Presbyterian newspaper, and he wrote regularly for more than a decade, had a column in that paper. So regionally well-known, denominationally well-known, but he was in a small context, Union Church in rural Jefferson County, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. He did not have a significant published volume. There was not a collected works written after or assembled after he died. So there would have been memory of him from those who sat under his ministry or who served alongside him in the church courts. There weren't these pieces of culture or literature produced that would have carried his memory on. So I think that's part of it. And, you know, on the one hand, that's a loss because here's a treasure trove of sources, a unique example of faithfulness, more than six decades in the same call. But also I think there's some instructiveness for Christians there because that's going to be most of our stories, isn't it? I mean, we're going to labor as hard as we can to serve Christ with the years that we've been given. But even the most fruitful servants of Christ are not widely known. And in a way, that's sort of the point. I mean, you know, if you were to survey America today, I would guess that far less than half of Americans would be able to tell you who George Whitefield was,
sure.
You know, but at his time was probably a household name. So if that's true of Whitefield, how much more for someone like Grafton or for us? So I do think there's a loss in terms of one vision of faithfulness, not just serving in a very significant, you know, not just faithfulness is serving in a significant pulpit, but faithfulness can look like serving in relative obscurity over a long time, multi-generational discipleship. So there is a loss there, but there's also some instruction and the lack of awareness people have for Grafton.
Yeah, he was certainly well accomplished, and he's also an interesting figure. We'll work through the different stops on his journey, but there's a kind of a fascinating shift and some interesting stuff. I was particularly arrested or struck by your treatment and description of his 1868 valedictory address at the University of Mississippi, and then moving to his seminary years and his early sermons. You know, here in my notes, at Ole Miss, he spoke of, you write this, of Plato, Galileo, and Newton inhabiting celestial halls. But by the time he was preaching his trial sermon before presbytery, only those who received Christ by faith, as we'd expect, belonged in heaven. So how do you understand some of his shift where he's including Plato, and then all of a sudden coming to a deeper awareness? What is his early religious life like in his university years? And was there a change or did he just mature?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I am altogether satisfied with my answer or lack thereof when I've thought about that. So a little biography.
What was his entrance essay to Ole Miss written?
Yeah, I don't think he had to write an essay. So he grew up in a covenant home, a family that had been a part of Presbyterianism in Mississippi from the very early days. He had descendants and relatives of descendants who were part of the first meeting of Mississippi Presbytery, mm-hmm. part of some of the first Presbyterian churches planted in Mississippi around the 1800s. So his family had been steeped in Mississippi Presbyterianism. His father was a ruling elder and precentor at the church where he grew up in Madison County, Mississippi. Towards the end of the Civil War, he entered in on the side of the Confederacy, served briefly after Confederate defeat, went to Ole Miss. And the sense I get from other accounts is that he would have been a Christian when he went there. Perhaps the most famous clergyman in Mississippi in the 19th century, Methodist Bishop Charles Galloway, was converted in a student prayer meeting that Grafton was a part of. So I think he would have been a professing Christian at that point. And feel very confident about that. He had been a member around the time of his going off to college of the local church and made a profession of faith. But in this valedictory address, he does speak in seemingly more universalizing terms than he would later preach. Sure. And I'm not sure if that's the rhetorical flourish of a young man speaking in his valedictory or if he had some category for great philosophers who weren't Christians entering into heaven. I find that difficult to believe. So I wonder if it's sort of a rhetorical flourish of the moment or a metaphorical representation of halls of learning. But that was surprising to me when I found it, because I knew how clear and staunch he had been on clear and exclusive gospel claims throughout his ministry, and also with the upbringing he would have had. Yeah. And so my hunch, and it's really just a hunch, is that this was a covenant child who made profession of faith as he grew older and had a rhetorical flourish that maybe he would have criticized later on. But I'm just
guessing. Yeah, I was surprised by that too. That address also surprised me in another way, and people might be interested to see this. This isn't a huge feature of the whole dissertation. This isn't a dissertation about the Civil War or the postbellum era, so to speak, but we have to touch on it because this was delivered in 1868. But in that address at the University of Mississippi, he calls the university this great pillar of the Union, which is quite striking, especially for a Confederate veteran to say only 3 years after the war, right? And you connect this with some other scholars' work, Gaines Foster, with their argument about former Confederates abandoning their vision of an independent slaveholding nation. I'm wondering, what does that tell us about Grafton? Is that representative of other people? Have they just moved on? I was particularly just interested to see within 3 years, just kind of the different conceptualizing of the University of Mississippi and the state in general as part of the Union, just moving forward.
Yeah, that's a great point. Two thoughts on that. One is, I think Grafton's address is consistent with Gaines Foster's long-held view that, you know, after the war, you don't see Confederates saying, generally speaking, you don't see them saying, we need to have a second try at a separate slaveholding republic. There's a moving on to now we are a part of the Union. Mm-hmm. And that's Foster's contention, and I think Grafton conforms to that contention. Another thing about Grafton's specific context, there had been troops stationed, Reconstructionist troops stationed in Oxford prior to his arrival in 1868, and things became really tumultuous after he left in the 1870s. But he was really in this little blip time after Union soldiers had been stationed, but before really aggressive, assertive attempts at what is sometimes called redemption, that there were cases of a professor and a former a Confederate officer, you know, disrupting a court hearing and these kinds of things. He was in this blip in the radar time. And so he conforms to Foster's observation, and he would have also been there at a time of more relative peace in terms of the local context at the university in those years.
Oh, interesting. What happens to Grafton after that? If you can connect some historical dots for us in terms of his graduating, leaving University of Mississippi, but eventually making his way into the pastorate. Can you speak about his theological education and then eventually his call to these two congregations?
Sure. So from Ole Miss, he went to teach school in Sardis, Mississippi, not too terribly far from Oxford, and would actually end up marrying the minister's daughter from that town. And after that, he went to Columbia Seminary, Old Columbia Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina. This is the 1870s. It's the time of William Swan Plummer. You have the influence of folks like Howe. Girardot, while not on faculty then, was in and around the area. You have Ruggles Wilson was there, later President Wilson's father, and also James Woodrow, the famous and controversial professor. So he was really at Columbia Seminary among some of the titans of the Southern Presbyterian Church in the 1870s, and had a thoroughgoingly Calvinistic Southern Presbyterian seminary education there in Columbia. One of my favorite stories about his time in Columbia, he had William Swan Plummer for one of his preaching courses. Now, Swan Plummer was twice a General Assembly moderator. and one of the most widely published authors in the Southern Presbyterian Church in that time. So really a significant figure. And he preached a sermon from Romans 10 on faith coming by hearing the word of God. And he has a personal note on the back of his sermon manuscript, rejected by Plummer, the source of heated disagreement among my brethren. And I think that was because of comments he made in that sermon with respect to infant salvation and how do we understand faith coming by hearing in cases of infant death. But I think to myself, wow, he must have had some fortitude if a twice GA moderator whose books are still in print 150 years later rejected his sermon and he just kept on going, you know. So as a part of his seminary education, and it's my sense that this was common at the time, the summer before his final year, he went back and served as a pastoral intern in Union Church. And I think that was sort of expected among students at that time that in their summers they would have some type of service to the congregations. That church went on to call him. It was a two-church call. He was there with at Union Church in Jefferson County and also at Bensalem in Lincoln County. And that's where he got married shortly after graduating and then moved right on down and began pastoring.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, speaking of those sermons, and that's one manuscript you mentioned with a really amazing note. Those are the best things to find when you're doing primary source research, you know, to find notes like that and marginalia. They're like little mysteries or little keys that unlock puzzles. But you've had access to hundreds of Grafton sermon manuscripts. You know, other than this, his biographer from the 40s, you probably read, I wouldn't imagine you, other than people in his own congregation, you probably read the most out of them, out of anybody. But after immersing yourself in all that material, you conclude that the thrust of his ministry obviously was religious. Now, that might seem like an obvious thing to say, but there's really an emphasis on conversion and a holy kind of consecrated living, and that the social and political commentary, which we might have expected, was actually rather rare. And even if he did mention something, it was always subordinate to spiritual aims. I'm wondering about if you could expand on that assessment and just maybe even talk more in general about your experience of immersing yourselves in so many, you know, you're getting, I don't even know the spread of this if they covered all 61 years of his ministry, but what is it like just to read all these sermons and kind of like ingest them like a fire hose? What did you notice?
Sure. So many thoughts come to mind. One, just about the general point of his ministry having primarily religious aims. That might seem, you know, obvious to folks like us who are Presbyterian pastors and elders. But I had in mind there, in part, the thought that sometimes folks will approach religious history and assert or imply that there are fundamental, that more fundamental than theological convictions are economic or class or racial or whatever considerations. And what was just clear from the evidence in Dr. Grafton's manuscripts was that his primary aims were the conversion and consecration of the people who heard him preach. That if we're to take the sources at face value, his aims were primarily religious, and that we would do an injustice to the sources to reduce, to try to find a motive under the motive. Well, what was he really after? Well, he tells us what he's really after. He's after glorifying and enjoying God by preaching Christ to see people converted and to see them grow. So that happens to be my own view of the ministry too, but I think the sources bear out that that was his view. In terms of spending time in his sermon manuscripts, there were loads of fascinating things to see how his manuscripts changed over time. And pastors who would listen to this can relate. You know, there are times when he's writing full manuscripts. There are times when he's just writing outlines. There are times when there'll be margin notes. There are times when things will be very polished. And so there's a variety that comes and goes, I'm sure, with his family circumstances, with the needs of the congregation at that particular time. He approached, his preaching was largely doctrinal, often preaching small texts of scripture with a doctrinal point and with specific application. There was a real emphasis on how the preached word would affect the practical lives of the congregation. So theologically deep, theologically rooted. This is someone who throughout his decades-long ministry would read the Greek New Testament daily, but also really aiming at things like family religion, Sabbath observance, love for the means of grace, those sorts of things. So it was fun to think about, you know, what would he take with him in the pulpit, and how did he choose the text that he would choose, and those kinds of things as he was going about his ministry.
How long were his sermons typically? I thought this was a little interesting tidbit.
He has an anecdote about that. You know, he speaks at one point in his ministry about people leaving, people who grew up under his ministry or in a country church, and they go off to big city churches that might be more polished, kind of more machine-like in their liturgy or in their operations. And he said they come back home and they can, you know, chafe against the long preaching. Yeah. They've gotten used to shorter sermons. And he says a 30-minute sermon has never been tolerated in our pulpit.
A sermonette.
You know, we preach 40, 50, 60 minutes. And he says the hearer shrugs at the length, but the preacher goes right on preaching.
I love it.
And he had another anecdote where he referenced a lecture or a talk that John L. Girardeau gave on preaching. And he quotes Girardeau, who encouraged the men, you know, don't feel constrained to the rules of rhetoric. If you feel hot, preach hot. You know, if you feel passionate, preach passionate. And then Dr. Grafton wrote his own little note, and if you feel long, preach long. So it seems to me that he wasn't overly concerned with going too long, and that if he preached 45 minutes to an hour,
that's just how it was.
That was normal for him. And I should hasten to say, probably the expectation of the most of the congregation as well.
Was that indicative, you think, of just his ministry, or more of just the rural ministry? I don't know. I mean, did you have any? I guess the bigger question I should ask is just how much his ministry is unusual in terms of the length and the extraordinary nature of serving in the single call, two congregations, but in a single call for 61 years. But were there other aspects? What percentage of his ministry would you say was representative or indicative of a typical rural ministry in Mississippi at the time?
I think his example was more typical. It was still unusual in its own context. There's no doubt about
remarkable.
That, 61 years. But I think it was more normal then than it is now, both in terms of the rural context and also in terms of the longevity of his ministry. So not 60 years in most cases, but if you had somebody 30, 40 years in one situation, that would have been more common then, I think, than it is now. It would be hard for me to judge, you know, how his sermon lengths compare, but it might be helpful just to think about some of the contextual elements. For much of his, perhaps most of his ministry, if you're going to get to church, you're going to walk. And he had members of his congregation who, because of the way they understood the fourth commandment, did not want to ride a horse
exactly.
on Sunday. And so you might be a mile or two from church and there might not be well-developed roads. And you probably, as far as I can tell, didn't have an adult Sunday school. So if you're going to walk your family a mile or more to church on the Lord's Day for one service, and you might not even be able to get there every week if the roads are washed out or something, you can understand why there would be a desire to make that time together, put as much into that time together. I think there's probably also an expectation piece among the congregation, whereas many congregations now would not expect a sermon that would be 60 minutes long.
Right.
I think that was more common then. But if you're pastoring a group of people and you're thinking to yourself, for part of his ministry at least. I'm in Union Church one Sunday. I'm in Bensalem the next Sunday. I need to feed them. You know, this is what they're going to get to chew on to satisfy their souls for a week, perhaps 2 weeks. How can I really help them and serve them in this time that they've taken such a long time to get here? I'm probably not going to preach 15 minutes if they've taken more than an hour to walk their family here. So the context helps us understand why that might have been more normal.
Oh, that's a great point. You also described some more practices and Lord's Day, Sabbath practices that were typical. Often families, they wouldn't even heat the food up on Sunday because they were seeing that as work. They wouldn't clear the table. Sometimes it just food would get set out on Saturday night. They'd eat it on Sunday, but just leave it and then clean up the table even on Monday. And you mentioned even as Grafton is traveling and doing pulpit supply at different times throughout his ministry, he would most likely go on Saturday and then not even ride home on Monday. So his horse didn't have to work.
That's exactly right. There's a story of that comes from a minister who served this congregation in the 1960s. So this is more than 30 years after
graduate. Is this James Chatham?
That's right. Yeah. And he went to a family's house for lunch in the 1960s. Now you can imagine Mississippi in the summer, not the coldest place. And the family had set out this great big spread of, you know, Southern food, multiple probably homegrown vegetables, and probably chicken, if I had to guess, and set it out on Saturday night, put a napkin over it, and that's what they did. So there was undoubtedly a sense of the importance of the Sabbath day. And as I said, even people who would be reluctant to come to church if it meant they had to ride their if they had to ride their horse to church, they would have even felt like that was an infringement of the fourth commandment. So that was part of the culture. This community had it was called the Scotch Settlement. A number of Scottish Presbyterians had come to that area. There was still Gaelic being spoken and sung in the area well into the middle of the 19th century. So I think there's a strong culture of Sabbath observance, a particular vision of Sabbath observance, and then also is a priority of Dr. Grafton's preaching. So that was certainly a part of religious life in Union Church under his ministry.
Since we're somewhat on the topic, I got to mention this. I've read and I read lots of dissertations just as a natural course of my job and interviewing people and talking. I've other than someone who's advising people, I've probably read more than many. I must say, I think I found my favorite sentence of all dissertations. Page 132, you write, David Galbraith died in 1917. He was a horse. I love it. But let me continue, and then I'll let you comment. He says, Reverend C.W. Grafton rode David Galbraith, the horse, whom he named after one of his church members for nearly 20 years. He went to the burials, the weddings, the meetings of presbytery, the preaching services all around, and never failed his master by night or day. I just love that because it's one of these just interesting kind of quirky little facts. But if you start to think about this horse is just with Dr. Grafton, but if you think about him as his companion and moving him everywhere, like this horse is a significant feature of Southern Presbyterianism.
You know, that was a sentence. I'm glad you enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed writing it. a little bit of context there. That came from one of Dr. Grafton's columns in the Mississippi Visitor.
The quote did, yeah. I failed to say that there was a quote in there, right?
Newspaper. And he was writing kind of a memorial for his horse. But in the article, he says to the readers, the Mississippi Presbyterian readers, many of you know Dave Galbraith from our presbytery meetings. And it was just this sense of, you know,
he knew his
he
horse,
had been with him. When I was researching and writing that portion, I told my ruling elders at the church I was serving in Hattiesburg, I said, if I ever get a horse, I'm going to have to choose which one of you to name that horse after. I haven't done it yet, but each would be a worthy namesake. But he would have taken this, he would have ridden to all of the meetings of presbytery, most of which would have been multi-day affairs and here, there, and everywhere. And that's how he chose to spend one of his articles in the newspaper, was talking about his horse.
Tell me about the magazine. How did he come to write in that? What kinds of things did he address? What did you learn about him just reading his column?
Sure. So the Mississippi Presbyterians had a newspaper called the Mississippi Visitor from around about 1915 up until about World War II. And by then, Dr. Grafton would have been one of the senior most figures in Mississippi Presbyterianism. He was ordained in 1873. So that's, getting close to 40 years after his ordination, more than 40 years after his ordination. He was GA moderator in 1916. So yeah, it made sense that he would be someone contributing to this magazine. And shortly after it started, he developed a regular column called Dr. Grafton's Message. And they were sermonic articles that would cover a range of topics. He might include a letter he had received from his son, Thomas, who was a missionary, a PCUS missionary in China. He might draw spiritual reflections on a tornado that had passed through town. He might address a particular theological issue or practical piety issue like family worship. He might comment on one column that was syndicated had to do with a rise in sort of moral degeneracy in young men, why youth prisons were fuller and what needs to be done. And he commented on what we would call depression. So a whole host of issues, the through line being applying Orthodox Southern Presbyterian theology in practical ways to the lives of readers. And certainly I should add a lot of history to church history, especially Mississippi church history. Some of the pieces that would end up in his history, the 658-page history of Presbyterianism in Mississippi, started off as articles where he would tell anecdotes about missionaries or pastors and things like that.
One other very significant thing. I want to talk also about his unpublished history soon after this, but I think on this point, it's important that we speak about some of that Mississippi history, because Grafton has a significant role. You have a whole section on protesting about Grafton and his views and his actions against lynching. You document at least three instances where Grafton publicly condemned lynching. They were in 1882, 1899, and 1918. But in one of those cases, he actually ended up accusing his entire congregation of at least a form of complicity. What does this reveal to us about Grafton's views on the matter, about his views on justice? And also, I suppose we might say, we talked earlier a bit about his ministry and his desire to have a ministry directed at religious matters and not socio-political commentary. But in this case, we're also kind of crossing over where they overlap to a degree.
Sure. I'll try to make a couple comments to situate the answer and then approach the answer itself. A historian I know, we were having lunch one day, and he said, sometimes it feels like all we historians say is, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And, right. And I feel that Dr. Grafton's a good illustration of this, because we might think, you know, observing through records the 19th century, that everybody stacked up on every issue on one side or another. Either they were, if they were racist, pro-lynching conservatives, and they were, you know, pro-equality, anti-lynching progressives. Well, it's just more complicated than that. Grafton was, and here I'm in no way defending, I'm just describing his view. Grafton was a staunch defender of the racial social hierarchy that prevailed after the Civil War. He believed that God in his providence had ordered society for whites to be superior over blacks, and he talks about that explicitly. At the same time, you know, we might expect someone like that to turn a blind eye to this extra legal killing of African Americans. And that wasn't the case with Grafton. He was vocally opposed to it in multiple cases, and some that must have been costly to him. The first case was one of his elders at the Ben Salem Church, and he would have been in his 30s at this point, early on in his ministry. A session member had killed a black member of the community, and the other elders looked into it. He said he was trying to make some type of citizen's arrest or some type of arrest, and the elders said that what he did was permissible. Grafton submitted a protest to his own session when he was a man in his 30s, saying, no, the Word of God requires that lethal punishment is in the hands of the state, the magistrate, and that our brother should have shown a greater restraint in this instance. He submitted a protest to his own session. There was another case in Port Gibson a number of years later, and the case that you mentioned in Union Church in the 1919. And again, it's complicated because we said, well, Grafton is defending this hierarchy system on the one hand that obtained in the Jim Crow era, but on the other hand, he's saying the Bible gives private citizens no right to take lethal justice into their own hands. This is the purview of the state. And in the instance you mentioned, someone was killed, an African-American man was killed in Union Church, and he preached on the Sixth Commandment. And he gave a whole host of reasons why it was a wicked sin and terrible blot on their community, that it was done so close to families in the congregation, close to the cemetery where honored Christian dead were buried, close to the school where the community had pinned so much of its hopes, close to the churches, he says, where Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, is preached. And after going on in that way, he called his congregation. He said, everyone who confesses this to be a gross sin and evil in our community, rise to your feet. And he notes the entire congregation rose. In that sermon, he referenced the sin of Achan and how Achan's sin resulted in terrible consequences for all of the people of Israel. And he drew a parallel between that murder and his own context. And then after that, he said, I'm going to pray, and if the man who pulled the trigger is here, let him come forward and take me by the hand. But nobody came forward. And that he notes in the service, we observed the Lord's Supper, and thus ended one of the most solemn services that I can recall. But there were cases, tragically, Mississippi was the state with the most instances of lynching in the South in that period, late 19th, early 20th century. You had cases of people who turned a blind eye, or even in some cases excused lynching as a reasonable expression of outrage, and even co-opting Christianity in some ways to tolerate or defend that practice. You also had other people who opposed lynching strongly, but wedded their opposition to social and racial reform. And Grafton doesn't really fit in either of those boxes. He, on the one hand, defended the status quo in terms of the way society was structured, but on the other hand, believed very firmly that the Word of God gave no room for people to take lethal justice into their own hands. He called it a sin. He preached against it. And I'll pick on one more thing that you mentioned. You know, Southern Presbyterians are often known for the doctrine of the spiritual mission of the church. And I don't think he would have seen this as a transgression of that principle. He would have said the Word of God is explicit in condemning murder. Right. And so this is a clear application of an explicit scriptural command. I think that's how he would have seen that, not as contradictory to the spiritual mission of the church, but part of the normal outworking of the preaching of the Word.
No, I think that's a good way to understand that and a good way to contextualize them. I think quite accurate from all I can tell. You know, we mentioned earlier, and I need to get this before we run out of time here, but I would like for you to explain and talk a bit about his unpublished history. He spent apparently 3 years writing a 658-page history of Presbyterianism in Mississippi. It was funded by the Eastman Memorial Foundation, yet even though they commissioned it and funded it, they never published it. And this was a kind of a real sore spot for him. What happened? And what's the book like? Because I presume you've read it.
His grandson made the comment that the only time he saw him angry at another person was when he got the letter that they weren't going to fund the history. So what happened, there had been histories written of other denominations in Mississippi. This is the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And there was a desire among Presbyterians to see a Presbyterian history of the state written. This foundation based out of Laurel, Mississippi, said that they would put up the money for it. And a committee was formed within the Mississippi Synod, if I recall, to pursue this project. The committee asked multiple people to write it. Thomas Carey Johnson was the first one they asked, who wrote Robert L. Dabney's biography, among other books. And another historian, or another figure whom I've not been able to identify. In the meantime, while they're trying to identify an author, and they're getting turned down multiple times, Grafton's leading this committee, and he's receiving information, and people are sending him data. And so the project just kind of fell to him. So as sad as I am that the foundation didn't pay for it, I do understand, you know, if they thought they were getting one of the preeminent, you know, historians of Southern Presbyterianism at the time to write it, and the project fell to him. But he went about it with great diligence. You can tell in his correspondence how he had made it a matter of prayer, how he felt he was burdened to do a good job with it, especially so that he could transmit the stories of past faithfulness to the children of the Presbyterian Church in the 1920s. And he finished the project in 1927, and they decided not to publish it. You read it. Now, I say this as someone who has deep affection for Dr. Grafton and for Mississippi Presbyterian history. Some chapters are stronger than others. You know, there are some wonderful chapters with hard to find content about, that is hard to find elsewhere in terms of the pioneer missions to Mississippi around 1800, missions to the natives in the northern part of the state, religious persecution when Mississippi Territory was under Spanish control. Mm. And Grafton was in a unique position because the church he pastored was before him pastored by one of those pioneer missionaries. So he would have had people in his church who were pastored by one of the first missionaries to Mississippi ever to come. And, you know, he had people in his church that went on to live into the 2000s. So he uniquely equipped historically to write, but the style is sermonic in nature. And there are other, you know, he has a chapter where he'll talk about, these are the people who are Presbyterian who have taught in state colleges. Or let me tell you about the Battle of Kings Mountain in the Revolutionary War. Well, that didn't happen in Mississippi, but it involved a lot of Presbyterians, and he thought it was great. So he has a chapter on it. You know,
there it is.
But really neat accounts of mission, of church planting. He received information from people all throughout the state. So part of it is his writing. Part of it is almost this assembly of local histories that were written by local congregations and other places. Fascinating, I think, both for its contents, and this is why I would love to see it published. It's fascinating both for its contents, and the style is such that any lay reader could pick it up and enjoy it, but also as an artifact itself, what it tells us about how Grafton and Christians in his time understood their own context, understood the role of history, understood the events that led up to their own life and ministry. So I think it's fascinating. I think it would be well worth publishing, maybe someday soon.
Well, maybe you can co-edit it with him or something, or go work on it. That sounds fascinating. I got one more question for you. I'm happy to keep talking, but often with these histories and with these figures, it's really interesting where the you know, you look. I want to look at the big picture and the retrospective, and what does Grafton as a whole and his life as a whole mean for us, and particularly perhaps even for ministers today. But often it's interesting just to think about the collection of the details. It's always the one and the many, so to speak. Grafton, as we mentioned, he served two small congregations for 61 years on a salary that rarely reached $600. He often was underpaid or not paid. He rode a horse, as we mentioned, for pastoral visits until he was 70. He ran a school for a decade on $10 a month, you're right. And he also turned down offers from larger institutions. So it wasn't as if he didn't have some other options and places he could have gone to avoid some of this, mundane hardships. I'm curious just what your big picture reflection is on him, on what motivated him, what sustained him, and what does his life and maybe even his examples say to us today, many years later?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so many thoughts come to mind. We've only scratched the surface mm-hmm. on his personal life in terms of, it's seven children, two died in infancy.
Oh, goodness. I forgot
two
to ask
more
you.
Died yeah. in,
his wife passed
in teenage years and his first wife. And so, all of this ministry is going on while he's enduring hardship, the death of his spouse, multiple children. And that's, I think, a instructive thing, as he's going and serving his congregation and then actively engaged in denominational life, he's having to live the Christian life himself. And one of my favorite lessons to take from Grafton is that he went to the same gospel for his own help that he offered to other people. Or to put it differently, the truths he preached to others were the truths he relied on himself. The Christ he offered to others was the Christ he depended upon himself. And that, I think, is one of my favorite lessons to draw from his life for ministers, that we, as I put it when I spoke at Greenville, we are offering cups of living water to other people from which we have first drunk ourselves. It also seems to me, this is a bit conjectural, but it seems to me that he did not set out to have a 61-year ministry in Union Church. Mm-hmm. There were different points where he might have gone somewhere else and for one reason or another didn't. As you mentioned, he was offered numerous other positions. He was offered the presidency of the University of Mississippi, a theology chair in one of the Southern Presbyterian schools. He had two honorary doctorates. So there were obviously instances in God's providence where doors were open that he didn't go through and then chose to remain and stay there. And later in his life, and this was striking to me, he said, "One of the reasons for staying is that I have learned how to live on so little. And I don't believe that younger men would be able to do this. And I take from that, so I am able to serve fruitfully in a place where others might not be able to. Mm-hmm. And I have learned after decades of living on, that's roughly the equivalent of, say, $18,000 a year in our money. I'm able to do that. And in order for this part of the Lord's vineyard to be cared for, that's something I'm able to do that other men might not be. And so I'm willing and eager to stay." And of course, by the end of his ministry, he had become such a fixture in that community, not just among Presbyterians, but across denominations, that if needs arose, people would have been eager to care and to help. So, wow. Certainly. And that's the case for so many of our ministries. Our aim every day is to go faithfully serve the Lord Jesus Christ, and God opens some doors and shuts others and the timing of his providence. And I think for him too, it was just an aim to be faithful to Christ that he might've not initially thought is going to be a 6-decade-plus ministry, but that daily faithfulness ended up being 61 years in that one call.
Amen. We've been speaking today about Mississippi's greatest minister, the historical study of Cornelius W. Grafton's 61-year pastor at 1873 to 1934, a dissertation by our guest today, Dr. David T. Irving. Thank you, David, for spending the time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure many people will. I was able to download this dissertation right online. I'll try to find the link directly to it and share it with others. But we hope that you're continue to be able to teach and plumb the depths of this history and share more with us down the road.
I hope so too. I hope it'll be an encouragement to folks.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I do want to encourage people to head over to rts.edu for more information, particularly the Jackson campus. And we also encourage you to visit us at reformedforum.org for information on all we have going on. We have many new courses that have been published over at reformedacademy.org, but we have quite a few events lined up, including we're going to have a little bit of a meetup the Monday night of PCA General Assembly. That'll be free. We'll have information on that to come for people that are going to be there and would like to attend. A seminar in Birmingham, Alabama toward the end of August. Our annual conference at the end of September here in the Chicagoland area, and then a big celebration in Austin, Texas, February 19th and 20th for the 1000th episode of Christ the Center. So we're really excited about that. Lots of details. I can't keep them all in my head, but you need to go to the website just like me for the information, reformedforum.org. I do want to thank everybody for watching and for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.